Morning, church. So those of you who haven't been around Harvest for Christmas yet don't know this, but I really only have like one pet peeve bugaboo in my entire life, only one. I never rant about anything much at all, ever. But at Christmas, those of you who have been around for a while know that I have this thing about the nativity scenes and the accuracy of it. Subject to what we read about in the scriptures and kind of peeling away all the tradition that we have around it. So I thought we would start today because we're going to talk about the Magi, and I have this thing about the Magi. And so I thought we'd start today by setting up a more biblically accurate nativity scene. Does that sound good? Okay. So first of all, the first problem is, so we have this stable. It probably wasn't a stable. But that's fine. We can go with this. That would only be speculation. But did you know that, like, on the night Jesus was born, the star doesn't figure into the story? You know that, right? You're like, I think this guy's a heretic. No, it's not. Read the Gospels. I am not. The star does not figure into the story the night of. What does figure into the story, of course, let me set these guys aside, but we know that we had some shepherds that came by that night. I have two of these shepherds. Here's another one here. We know the shepherds came because the angel came and announced to them. I have an angel here. You know that it's an angel because it has wings. Okay, we'll just go with that. So, but the angel did you know the angel doesn't actually appear at the nativity scene? If you read the scriptures, it's always there in all the storybooks and all the movies, but the angel went to the hillside. The angel talked to Joseph in a dream. The angel talked to Mary directly, and the angel went and talked to the shepherds, but never actually shows up for the event. But we'll put it there because at least it happened within the same time period in the same neighborhood, so we'll allow the angel to be there. And then we have Mary's here somewhere. Here's Mary. We'll put her in there. She was definitely there at the birth. And we have some animals. Do you know there's no actual indication that there were any animals there? But it was in a stable and there was a manger. So it's fine, whatever. And then baby Jesus is here, right, in the manger. And no Joseph. I think Joseph must have been out getting more swaddling cloths. Come on, that was funnier than that. It was. I worked hard on that. All right, and then we got these guys. And I don't know why there's three, because the Bible doesn't say there were three. But we have three. Can I toss this to you, Stuart? Thanks. But we have these three Magi, or these three wise men. We'll talk about that later. But they were not there that night. They didn't show up. There wasn't an angel and all the shepherds and Mary and Joseph and the little drummer boy and the Magi. It didn't all come together in one night. And we're going to talk about that later. But Evie, do you mind giving me a hand here for a second? Evie, do you mind taking these Magi in order to be more theologically accurate? I want you to take these Magi and I want you to take them to the cafe in the south lobby and put them on the shelf. Thanks, Evie. And we're going to leave them there because on the night of Jesus' birth, they were far, far away, and it was going to take some time before they would ever get to Bethlehem, and a lot happens in the meantime, and that's what we want to talk about today. We want to have a theologically gospel-accurate nativity scene as we continue in this series that we've called A Five Guys Christmas, and we look at another group of guys called the wise men or a magi, depending on the translation of scriptures that you have. And the way they're depicted in nativity stories, and you're already picking this up, if you've been here for a while, you know that we talk about this from time to time, but the way they're depicted in the nativity stories is encumbered with all kinds of tradition that has been added after the fact, not part of the biblical account. But what we know about the magi is so profound, and it points to God's good and gracious intervention, a shocking intervention into the world to provide a way of salvation for humanity. And what we see in the Magi, in their story, the details we do have, the important details that we can lock down and say, this is scripture. What we see in the Magi is an approach to God that compels from us worship and adoration of the Savior and King. And we're going to ask the question, as we look at the text today, we're going to ask the question of ourselves, what does it mean to bow to the King? That's what we see the Magi do. We need to ask that question for ourselves and come to some conclusions. What does it mean to bow to the king? And so I'm going to read Matthew 2, the first 12 verses, and I'm going to tell you right now, these are the only verses we have about the Magi in the entire scripture. Everything we know about the Magi from the scriptures right here in this passage. I'm going to read it right now. Matthew 2, beginning at verse 1. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose, and we have come to worship him." When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. And they told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea. For so it is written by the prophet, 'And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.' Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, 'Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him.' And after listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way." All right, on the screen in your notes, you're going to see this, and this is what we want to lock down. We've asked the question already, as a believer, I must bow to the king having these four things that we see in the Magi. This is what I want to have. And we're going to see this first. We want to have a sincere longing to be with him. Now, as I said, these 12 verses are everything we know about the Magi's visit to Jesus. We know more about the Magi from historical records, but notice that this visit came. We want to lock down the timing and figure out why it is that the Magi aren't here and the Magi are out in the south lobby right now. The visit came, verse 1, notice, it came after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king. And when it says after, it means some time after. It didn't happen right away. They weren't all there together. From verse 8, in fact, by this time we find out the word that is being used to describe Jesus is the word child, not the word for baby or infant, but the word child. Jesus, by this point, this would be a word that would be used for a small child or a toddler. I don't like using that word for obvious reasons. I don't like the word toddler. That was a slow burn. I get it. It's fine. So this is he's a young child by this point. The word used for that is he is a small child. And then based on Herod's later instructions in verse 16 to kill all the male babies up to age 2, we can conclude that Jesus was 18 to 24 months old, about 2 years old at this point. Further, one final little detail is we know that this isn't happening in the stable or whatever it was, wherever the animals were, where they had rested for the night. But they visited, these Magi come and visit the family who are now, verse 11, in a house. And so by this time, Joseph, the baby had been born. Joseph had secured a place for them to stay. He wasn't about to take Mary back to Nazareth right away with a small baby. And so while the baby is growing and Jesus is growing there, the little family has settled in the town of Bethlehem. And they're living in a house. And so again, conclusion, the Magi didn't come at the same time as the shepherds did. And that's why we've put the Magi where they are. Some months later is when they finally came to see Jesus, to see the young family. Now back to verse 2. We're going to find out where they're actually from, but it is some distance away in another country. And as they're there, verse 2, they don't know that the place that they're going is this little town called Bethlehem. The star that they see rise for them, they're in the east. The star rises. When it says the star rises in the east in certain translation, it means they were in the east seeing the star rise. For them, it was actually west of them. But when they see this star rise, The star gets them thinking about a king that's born in Israel, and the star is going to take them to the capital of Israel, is going to take them to Jerusalem. Just the star rising in the sky, just its appearance, is going to compel them to go to Israel, where they go and they ask King Herod the question, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. Now, this is the question. How did they know about the star? These are Babylonians. They live hundreds and hundreds of miles away. How did they know about the star? To answer that question, we need to have a little history lesson. Okay, first service cheered. I'm just saying. We need to have a little history lesson. Yes, yes, yes. 500 years prior to the Nativity, what we're talking about here, 500 years prior, the Jews had been carried into exile by King Nebuchadnezzar. He was the Babylonian, the king of the Babylonian Empire, and he had conquered Israel, and he was carrying the best of the Jews off into exile in Babylon. And Babylon was the home base for the Magi, the wise men. These Magi throughout Babylonian history had been both astronomers in the sense that they would study the cosmos and they would try to understand it from a scientific standpoint, studying the movement and the courses of the stars. They were not just astronomers, though. They were also astrologers in the sense that they were then looking for those stars to read something out of them, to get a sign and to predict things that were going to happen on Earth. Now, we can look at that as Christians and go, well, that's wacky, and why are people doing that, and horoscopes, and yada, yada, yada. We can do all of that, but at the very least, let's commend the search. Let's commend the fact that there are people who are looking into the creation to try to figure out, why are we here, and what's our purpose, and who really are we, and how does it all fit together? We can commend them at least for searching. And then they have this blend, this crazy blend of both science, astronomy, and this religion philosophy of astrology. And that combination in that culture at that time of history gave them power and knowledge to influence kings and kingdoms. In fact, they were advisors to rulers of various kingdoms and empires, and they were considered in antiquity to be, and this is a key word when describing the Magi, they were considered to be king makers. They were king makers because of their influence. They would steer decisions and control successors to thrones. They were intelligent. They sought knowledge. They were educated, scholarly. They were wealthy and influential over centuries of human history. And it's speculated from this, and it's not a difficult speculation, but 500 years prior to the Nativity, the Jews are leaving Israel and they're carrying with them some of the cultural things that are most important to them, not the least of which for a Jew would be the Torah. They would carry with them the Hebrew scriptures. And you can imagine them setting up in Babylon and setting up their communities and having places where they could still meet in makeshift synagogues so they could still hear the reading of the Torah. They could still learn about Yahweh, their God. And the Magi, seeing these peoples come in, Israel wasn't the only country that was conquered and peoples that came, but the Magi from each of these peoples who would come and the writings that they would bring, the Magi would want to learn because they were scholars and they would love to investigate and learn new things. And as the Jews came bringing the Torah, you can imagine the Magi saying, we got to read their book and we got to learn everything we can about the Jews. And so read they did. And they worked through the Torah, and they got to the fourth book. These are the first five books of our Old Testament. And they got to the fourth book, the book of Numbers, and they came to chapter 24 and verse 17. And here's what they heard. Here's what they read. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, Now, I'll read the rest in a minute, but you can imagine, like, their spidey senses just go off as soon as they see the word star, right? Like, the magi spidey senses are going crazy because they just read about a star, and this is the thing. Stars are the thing that excite them more than anything. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. Now, what's crazy about this prophecy, if you go back to the book of Numbers and you read that whole section, several chapters of the book of Numbers, that this is a prophecy that is spoken by a guy named Balaam. And Balaam is not a worshiper of Yahweh. He's a false prophet. And he gets hired by the king of Moab because the Israelites are making their way to the promised land. And the king of Moab's not excited about them coming through his land. And so he hires Balaam to put a curse on the Israelites. And every time, three times, Balaam opens his mouth to pronounce a curse on the Israelites, and three times, blessing comes out. Try as he might, Balaam can't put the curse, and the king of Moab's losing his mind because he's paying this guy to do a job. But he can't do it. And that's the prophecy. One of the prophecies that Balaam delivers is about a king who's going to come and a star that's going to rise to announce the birth of the king who will shepherd the people of Israel. A pagan false prophet delivers this prophecy, and pagan astrologers in Babylon are the ones who receive it and see it fulfilled. It's a prophecy about a star. And for 500 years, they're so jazzed about receiving this prophecy and reading in the book of Numbers, that for 500 years, what they do is they teach the next class of magi, and they teach the next class of magi, and all the way through 5 centuries of keeping the memory alive about this verse in Numbers in the Torah. And they did it until that star appeared over Jacob, over the people of Israel. And being kingmakers, they saddled up and they traveled, no doubt, with a very large entourage of magi and servants and security. This is where the star figures in, because the star is entirely tied to the magi story, and it's not tied to the night that he was born in the sense that the shepherds didn't see it and they didn't notice it and Mary and Joseph didn't, and it wasn't part of the narrative that night. But it's very likely that the star did appear that night to announce the birth. But the magi being hundreds and hundreds of miles away and needing to travel with a large entourage would have needed many, many months to prepare for this journey. And in their mind, there would have been no rush to get there. But it would have taken a long time to prepare because, listen, I know we have 3 magi. I know that that's tied to the gifts, and we'll talk about that in a moment. There was likely more magi than just 3. And they would have had their servants, and they would have had their cooks, and they would have had servants who would have carried packs, and they would have had all kinds of pack animals, and they would have needed servants that took care of the animals, and they would have needed soldiers and security to go along with such a large caravan. And because it was a large caravan, it would have taken forever for them to journey through the Fertile Crescent, up from Babylon, and then back down into Israel. And so this is a big deal. This caravan from the east, it would have created a stir in Jerusalem. This is like a massive parade of foreigners who are known to be influential in politics just arriving in your town. But this was the natural place for them to go. They needed to go to the capital because they were looking for a king. And so this large caravan arrives, verse 3, when Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. I mean, he's the king. And the message he's getting is there's going to be a new king. You know, I feel like Justin's thinking about this right now. You know, it's like, that's as political as I get, folks. Like, you're the king, I'm the king. What do you mean there's a new king? So he's upset. Verse 3, when Herod heard this, he was troubled, all Jerusalem with him. This new king is a threat to his power, to his throne. Not to mention the fact that Israel at this point is under the Roman Empire, and there's an emperor in Rome who doesn't take kindly to other kings rising up. Everyone knows when they come into town, everyone knows they're magi. And everyone knows what magi do. They're kingmakers. Anyways, Herod receives them because he does want to show his cards. He needs more information. And so, verse 4, he calls together the chief priests and the scribes to answer their question. He asks them where the Christ, the Messiah, was to be born. Herod knows enough of the prophecies to know that it relates to a promised one. He knows the scriptures point to a promised one, a Messiah, a king. And then he asks the scribes to let him know more of the details, where exactly he's going to be born. Verse 5, the answer comes in Bethlehem, Judea. Bethlehem, by the way, 9 kilometers from Jerusalem. It's very close. 9 kilometers from Jerusalem. The scribes quote the prophet Micah, chapter 5, verse 2, saying this. This is verse 6. And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. You're such a small little town, but you're not. For from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Speaking of the Messiah. So he gets this information, verse 7. Herod then pulls the Magi back in for a secret meeting that no one else is going to hear. And he finds out, he asks him a question. When exactly did this star appear? Now, why does he ask that question? Because it had happened so many months before, and Herod's trying to figure out the age of the child so that he can hatch his plan that you read about in the next verses of chapter 2 in Matthew, where he's going to go and kill all the male babies, certain age, all the children a certain age down, 2 years old and under, because of what the Magi had told him. And so he sent them to Bethlehem, verse 8, saying, go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him. He has no intention of worshiping him, does he? His intention is only malicious. Now, what's exemplary in this account, as I read this, and I think about the history behind it and who the Magi were, what's exemplary to me is that from 500 years prior, and all the Magi that existed through all the generations down to this moment in history, that they had this longing inside of them to preserve this information, a longing to see this king when he arrived, and then to make the long and arduous and very expensive journey from Babylon to Israel to see him. And based on that little nugget of information that we can distill about the Magi, based on that alone, I have one question for you. Is your longing to be with Jesus so deeply held, so gripping of your soul, that you would give up anything to be with him? Does your heart ache at times to be with Jesus? Do you feel, as you live your daily life, I had a conversation with someone yesterday about this, but do you feel as you live your daily life the dissonance between you as a Christian and this world that we're living in? The dissonance that says, I don't really belong here anymore. That I'm longing more than anything else to be with Jesus. Because I don't quite fit here. I'm not a citizen of this world. I'm a citizen of a heavenly kingdom. I'm a resident alien here on earth as a Christian. That dissonance, every Christian should feel that. I don't belong here. There's a sense of that being eternal, like I can't wait to be with Jesus. That's the bigger and ultimate fulfillment, obviously. But I should also have a longing to experience whatever small glimpses of that eternal reality I can get while I'm here. While I'm feeling the dissonance with the world, I want to have moments where I don't feel that when I'm in the presence of God. And for sure, every one of us as Christians should be developing that in terms of our personal time with Jesus when we're opening the Word for ourselves and we're praying to Him, trying to talk to Him about the things that are going on in our lives. And we have this two-way fellowship between us and God, us praying to Him and Him speaking to us in His Word. And in those moments, I'm not going to say it's going to happen every time, but I'm telling you, there should be moments when you're doing that, unhurried, undistracted, where you would walk away going, I've been with God. And then, not only personally, but you know this thing that we do on Sundays? That's what this is. Like, this is meant, as imperfect as this is, and it's very imperfect. But as imperfect as this is, that's what this is. That I'm trying to just step out of the world for a moment and have an experience with God's people where we get into the presence of God. And hopefully I just don't feel the dissonance during this time. But I feel a little bit more of that longing for Jesus to be in His presence fulfilled in these, again, very imperfect moments. And there should be nothing, I'm just going to tell you, there should be nothing that keeps us from these times together. Some of us allow trivial things to keep us from this place or to keep us from our personal times with the Lord. Some of us allow so many other priorities to creep in and keep us from regularly meeting with God's people, or regularly meeting with the Lord on our own. And if that's you, if you allow trivial things and other priorities to come in, then you're not displaying the thing that we're seeing in the Magi here, who are putting out great expense to be there. If a little weather, or I'm a little tired today, or any of the slightest excuses we might use, or kids' sports, or whatever it is, if these things keep us from worshiping Jesus, then you don't quite get what these Magi were feeling and the extent to which they were willing to go to be in the presence of the King. A sincere longing to be with Him, as imperfect as it is. Long to be with Jesus. When we bow to the King, we long to be with Him. Here's a second. I must bow to the King, having an eager anticipation to know Him. It's not just I want to be with Him, but when I'm with Him, I want to know more about Him. It's not just about presence, but about increasing my experience of who He is. They heard what Herod had said, these Magi, verse 9, and they went on their way to Bethlehem, traveled the 9 kilometers, and behold, the star that they had seen when it rose alerted them to the birth of the King. Now, it's interesting that the star comes back here. So what we understand about this star is that it rose, they saw it, and the rising of it told them to go to Israel. It's not like from Babylon, the star rose in Babylon and they trotted after the star. It wasn't leading them in that way. It rose because of the prophecy in Numbers, they knew to go to Jerusalem. So they did. They didn't see the star after that because it rose and then it went. They knew that was the sign, so they went. But then once they got to Jerusalem, as soon as they have the conversation with Herod, as soon as they find out it's Bethlehem, but they don't know what house, and they don't know who these people are, the star reappears. And that's what we see happening here. Behold, the star that they had seen when it rose, this alerting them to the birth of the King, reappears now and leads them. Now it's doing the leading. It went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. And look at their response. This is how you know they hadn't seen it for a while. Verse 10, when they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. They were thrilled to see the star again because it confirmed the entire journey and everything they had gone through. They had such an eager anticipation to know Him, to see Him with their eyes, and to find out, because they didn't know, to find out who He actually is. And the Magi, we need to be careful about putting too much on them,
because the Magi certainly didn't understand the full extent of what was happening around them and how God was using them. They didn't know where all of this was going. In fact, no one did. Mary and Joseph didn't know where it was going. The shepherds didn't know where it's going. They were just taking the steps that God had put in front of them in the moment. They were doing what they needed to do to find out more. Of all the things that are happening here, there's so many things happening in the church right now that are so encouraging. And I'm encouraged by what God is doing in this place. On Sundays, just so you know, I basically have two jobs on Sundays. My first job, you're seeing me do it right now, is I bring the word. My second job is I go to Guest Central at the end of this service and I greet newcomers to our church. And that's a big priority for us to have those conversations and meet new people and put a gift in their hand. Listen, in the last month to the month and a half, I have had so many conversations with people who are not yet believers. Maybe some in this room that we've talked over the past several weeks and who are saying to me things that make it sound like you're just like these Magi. You're taking the steps that are right in front of you. You're sensing something big is happening in your life. You're wanting to read the scriptures and find out. You're wanting to be with God's people and experience what's going on here. You want to get in conversations with people. You want to do studies because you're on a journey. A spiritual journey to find something out about God, and you don't know where it's going to take you. And the Magi certainly did not know where all of this was going, but they're taking every step they need to take to find out. Now, from the data we have, we can't even really say that these Magi are believers. And by believers, what I mean at the time is that they would have been like converts, proselytes of Judaism. We don't really have any sense that they were Yahweh worshipers. They're simply taking steps that were put in front of them by Magi from hundreds of years prior. They are seeking. They are being led by God to fulfill his will. They are being used by God to tell his story. And that's all God asks of any of us, wherever we are right now. Take this next step that's in front of you, the step that he's leading you to take. Now we know more. We know more than the Magi. We've been given the whole story. We have the gospel in our hands. The Apostle Paul, he wrote a testimonial that kind of helps us understand a little bit more about what it means to know God in this way. Philippians 3, 10 and 11, Paul says, that I may know him. And by know him there, he doesn't mean like intellectual assent. He doesn't mean just like a cognitive understanding of who God is. He's not just adding information in, but this word is packed with experience. It's an experiential knowledge of God. That I may know him and the power of his resurrection and may share in his sufferings, becoming like him in his death, that by any means possible, I may attain the resurrection from the dead. Well, the Magi didn't know that, but that's where they were heading. And that becomes the goal for every one of us. I mean, this is part of Paul's testimony, but this needs to be imprinted, stamped on every testimony of every Christian. This is our testimony. This is our goal. That we would know Christ in this way, the power of his resurrection, the fellowship of his sufferings. Now, the Nativity is so special, and many of us, we just love this time of year for all the lights and the stories and the warmth that it brings. It's so encouraging and so hopeful, and it's a message of peace on earth. But the Nativity of Jesus Christ, his birth, as special as it is not enough. The incarnation of Jesus is a step in the journey that leads to the cross. It leads to his suffering. It leads to his life given in our place. And it leads to the glorious resurrection that defeated sin and death and gives us the opportunity to have a relationship with our God. And so when we say that we're eager to know him, That's what we mean. To know him in his power and glory. To fully experience who he is and everything that he's done for us. Again, the Magi didn't know all of that. But God had them pointing in the right direction for their sake and ours. He had them pointing to the cross and to the empty tomb. He had them pointing to the salvation that God was offering to the world through his Son, Jesus Christ. And like the Magi, if I want to know him, I have to bow to him. Here's a third. I have to have a generous offering to give him. So these Magi arrive in Bethlehem. The star lights the way. Verse 11, they went into the house and they saw the child with his mom and they fell down and they worshiped him. They honored him as a king. This little boy. The kingmakers of that period in human history. Kingmakers from a pagan country. Kingmakers who are Gentiles, not Jews, are used by God to acknowledge the king who would be the savior of the world. And what's awesome is they don't come empty-handed. They come with gifts, understanding that in bowing to the king, they need to honor him with gifts. Verse 11 continues, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense, and myrrh. Gold is obvious, a precious metal. Frankincense is incense. Myrrh is a spice. A lot has been written about the various gifts and the symbolic nature of them. I don't know about any of that. It's not in the passage to the scriptures. It's enough to mention what they are without telling us that they have any symbolic meaning. In the second, third century, one Christian theologian named Origen wrote this, and this is where a lot of the idea around symbolism of the gifts has come down to us, but he wrote this, gold as to a king, myrrh as to one who is mortal, and incense as to a god. And in that, Origen's right to say, like, he's capturing the essence of who Jesus Christ is. It's a beautiful Christology that we have in these three gifts. It speaks to who Christ is and what he would do for us. But it's not in the text. It's nice. You can tuck it away, but you can't really preach it strong because we don't know. But what we can say about the gifts is this. They were very, very expensive. These were valued gifts at the time. And from the text, what we might conclude from that, why did they give these gifts? What did Joseph and Mary do with these gifts? From the text, we might conclude that this sudden wealth given to Jesus' family funded their trip to Egypt. We read about that in verses 13, 14, and 15. Joseph was a poor man. He has to get out of Bethlehem fast. Herod is coming down with his soldiers to kill all the babies. God warns him to get lost. He's got to go to Egypt. He can't afford to go there until the Magi show up and give him the financial wealth so that he's going to be able to do that. God provided for them through the generous offering of the Magi. Now, without making too much of this, we see throughout the Bible principles and examples of giving and how it represents. Giving represents an act of worship. If we're talking about bowing to the king, we have to talk about bowing to the king with something in our hands. We don't come empty-handed. It's an act of worship on the part of every believer. Because when I attribute worth to God, that's what worship is. I'm attributing worth to God. God, you are worthy. When I attribute worth to God, I do so by giving back to him what he has so kindly given to me. And so the Magi model that. And I thought it'd be helpful to us to just put down very quickly four principles of worship, giving as worship, four principles that we see embodied here in the Magi. And you can jot these down and then say, like, is this me? So four questions. Is your giving, first of all, is your giving to God as an act of worship? You know, sometimes we hear people and they're like, well, I don't really give to the church, or I didn't give much to the church because, you know, I give to this charity or I give to that charity. I have my favorite cause, and so I kind of count that. And then I pay for my kids' Christian school tuition, so I kind of count that. And we're giving ourselves excuses to pay for things that we want to do rather than just giving it to God as an offering and an act of worship. And we see that modeled throughout the scriptures, that the giving is to God as an act of worship. Here's a second one. Is your giving without condition? Will I let God use it as he pleases? And among those who are in the lower and middle economic brackets, there tends to be more of the, here's my offering, I don't need to know how it's all being used. Here's my offering. And among those who are wealthier and who give gifts, very often what you see is, I would like my name on that. Could I get a plaque? You know, and I would like to have a say in how that is spent. And that's a challenge for those who are wealthy. But all of us need to give without condition to let God use it as he pleases. Here's a third. Is your giving generous? Is it generous? If not, sacrificial. Now here's the thing. You need to define what generosity is for yourself. That's between you and the Lord. I don't teach tithing. I put a post up on Facebook a few weeks ago. A lot of people liked it. Some people didn't. That's fine. I don't teach tithing. I don't believe it's just 10%. I don't believe that the scriptures teach that in the New Testament for Christians. I believe that we're called to something different than that. I believe that for some people to give 10% would be too much and it would crush your budget. And it would make it very difficult for you. I'm thinking about single moms who are just trying to put groceries on the table and pay their rent, pay their utilities. That might be really hard to carve out 10%, and you might be depriving your child if you do so. But then I'm thinking about some other people. I'm thinking of some other people who have a lot of money where 10% is like a slap in the face to God, considering what he's given. And there might need to be a reckoning that you have with you and your budget and the Lord, where you just go, you know what, I think I need to be giving a lot more than that. You have to decide, what's the point at which, when you're looking at your budget and you're working that out, and we're coming to the end of a year and we're going into January and you're going to be working out a new budget for the next year, and you're going to take your salary and you're going to pay all your expenses and all of that, and then you're going to look and say, like, what would be generous? And then you're going to ask the question, and what would be sacrificial? And then that's the number. That's what goes in to your budget. I'm going to do, by the way, in February, I'm going to do a whole series on discipleship with respect to money. I'm going to do 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 as the passage. That's in February, 4 weeks. It's been 8 years since I've taught anything around money. So if you don't want to hear anything about money, don't come in February. But now I've decided to do in January and not tell you. Here's a fourth one. Is your giving willing? Is it from the heart? That is to say, I want to give. I want to. And I want to do it joyfully. And God doesn't want your money if it has to be coerced out of you. He doesn't need your money. Okay? God wants you to want to give as an act of worship and an expression of your love for him. And there's enough in Scripture to indicate that blessing comes as a result of that obedience, that when I give to the Lord in that way, that there's going to be a blessing that is attached to that. And I'm not talking about necessarily material blessing, because that's prosperity gospel, and it isn't like give this much to God and he's going to pour it out to you financially. That's nonsense. That's not the gospel. But God will bless you in incredible ways. Blessing follows our careful obedience to what God says in his word. And we bow to the king and we bring him our gifts. Here's one more. As a believer, I must bow to the king, having a sensitive spirit to follow him. Notice in verse 12 that having presented their gifts and worshiped him, they were warned in a dream not to return to Herod because he only wanted to kill this new king. So they, you know, plugged alternate route into Google Maps and they took one of the other ways to get home to their own country. They showed a sensitivity to the spirits leading in their lives. And even in this, they're bowing to the king. In our obedience, in our listening for the spirit to lead us, we're bowing to the king. The application for us is almost unlimited when it comes to this. To have a sensitive spirit to follow Jesus affects no less than every aspect of our lives. Do you follow Jesus? In every aspect of your life, are you sensitive, attentive, thoughtful about what God requires of you as a Christian? Now think of it. These magi get this dream, and they're about to disobey the king of the country that they're in. They're not going to go the 9-kilometer route back up to Jerusalem, but they're going to bypass that. I don't know if they went east or west. There was 3 different routes that they could take to get back to their home country, but they took one of the other 2 alternate routes that did not go through Jerusalem, and that was risky. They were ignoring and disobeying the reigning king of that land. And he, by the way, is a vassal king under the Roman Empire, and the legions of Rome are there. If Herod wants to order soldiers to pursue the Magi and cut them down, even as they try to escape, he could. What they were planning to do was treasonous and subversive. And given that the whole episode involved a challenger for the throne, it meant that this was an act of aggression against the state. They had to follow Jesus, though. They had to do what God told them to do. And that's what we've been called to as Christians. Do what he tells us to do. Jesus made this super clear. There's like no way to escape it if you're a Christian. That we are called to do things that are risky. We are called to do things that will cost us. Jesus, in Matthew 16, verse 24, Jesus told his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." They're trying to understand what the implications are of following Jesus. Now understand, we read this from our perspective and see cross, and we understand exactly what that means. But from their perspective, before the cross, as Jesus is teaching them, they're a little puzzled by what he's saying. Jesus is saying to them, "I want you to take up your instrument of execution. I want you to take up your gallows, your guillotine. I want you to take up your gurney. I want you to take up your electric chair, and I want you to put you on the chair and throw the switch. I want you to execute you. I want you to be dead to self and follow me." Paul gives a little bit more understanding of that in Galatians 2:20 after the crucifixion resurrection. And again, in a very testimonial form, Paul says this in Galatians 2:20. He says, "I have been crucified with Christ. I have done what he told us to do. I've gone to the place of execution with him." Paul died on the cross. It's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. And that's bowing to the king. Amen. Have you died to self? Or are you still on the throne of your own heart? That's the 4. And here's how I want to close this. And I'm going to invite the worship team out, and we're going to go right into worship from this, because this is a message about worship. And I don't want you to be distracted by the other things that are going to happen on stage right now. I need you laser focused on just on what I'm going to say to you in these moments. But the Magi that we've been looking at, they longed for the day. They were eagerly anticipating the moment that they would see the king, that they would bring their offerings, and that they would follow him. Generations of Magi for 5 centuries had watched and waited for the star until they came to this singular moment in history. The Magi were focused, and they were willing to sacrifice greatly to worship the Messiah. Now here's the thing. Attention here. Whether you realize it or not, you are a worshiper. I'm not just talking to the people in the room who have Come to Jesus and have faith in him. I'm talking to everyone. I'm talking to everybody who's watching right now. All of you are worshipers. Every one of us is a worshiper. You may worship Jesus, as many in this room do, as many watching do, or you may worship some other small g god, or you may worship self. You may have yourself on the throne of your life, or you may worship one of the many idols that are out there for us to worship. You may worship money, you may worship sex, you may worship power, or you may worship goodness, you may worship family. That might be your god. You may worship friendship and relationships. There's all kinds of things that we can worship. The fact is, everybody worships. Knowing this basic human predisposition, a renowned author, he wrote this. Keep in mind, he was not a Christian. But he said, in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there's actually no such thing as atheism. There's no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. David Foster Wallace came to that conclusion despite the fact that he was raised by atheist parents. He's raised in a home that didn't believe there was a God, and yet he came to the conclusion that even though his parents said that, even though that was his experience, he knew that everybody worships something. Nevertheless, David Foster Wallace chose the wrong object of worship, or perhaps more accurately, he never found the right object of worship, despite the fact that toward the end of his life, he was actively going to church where he lived in Illinois. He'd gone to a couple of different kinds of churches, and he had settled into one where no doubt he heard the gospel. But he never received it. He was searching and trying to grasp it. And tragically, he took his own life in 2008 at the young age of 46, never having experienced the joy of worshiping the one true God. Never having received Jesus Christ as his Savior, never having come to him as the Magi did. Listen again to what he said. The only choice you get is what, or rather who, to worship. Every single person listening to me right now has that choice. You're going to leave here today worshiping something or someone. And the Magi got to Bethlehem. Going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshiped him. They bowed to the king. Will you bow to the king?